Let's see. Let me start my talk here. We're in Palestine trying to get ready to fly Strider. So here's a really quick recap. You guys can see the slide shot now, right?
Yes.
Great, excellent. So here's the vital statistics on Strider. It's a, as you know, it's a Bloom-borne 7-millimeter perimeter. It's gonna map 20% of the sky. Its noise and frequency coverage are designed to be able to get an R of 0.03 detection. Polarization modulation with a separate breakplate, and the first flight is coming up this winter. So we're integrating now, and we'll give a quick tour of that in a second here, just to show you where we are, that whole thing. I was asked earlier, so as somebody asked this question in order to, and it kind of made me happy that I already made this slide. Balloons are hard, so why in the world would you fly in a balloon? Besides the fact that it's incredibly fun, and Palestine is the center of U.S. culture. Beyond that, well, obviously there's less atmosphere at float. Well, is that important? Sort of two reasons. It gives you access to higher frequencies. So in principle, you can measure 280 gigahertz from the ground, but your noise is substantially higher than on a balloon. And my feeling from plots I've seen is that it's not gonna get particularly deep from the ground. Maybe in the best sites you can, but it's a real challenge. From a balloon, of course, it's really no problem. 280 gigahertz isn't really gonna get at it at all. And possibly more important is that from a balloon, you get access to larger scales. So in this plot here, we have the experiment transfer function as a function of angular scale for various scenarios. So what this is the filtering, it's a combination of all the filtering that has to be applied to the time stream in the map making process and the beam cutoff. So the beam cutoff, of course, doesn't matter if you're in the ground or in the sky, so you can kind of ignore that side, except it's real, because that's we have big beams on Strider. The one that that changes between balloon and float is how much of the large angular scales you can keep. So, there's a couple of curves here. The curve marked bicep and the curve marked BO3 are two actual curves from actual experiments that have flown and were operated. So BO3 is what we actually achieved with Boomerang 2003 in terms of the transfer function. And the one marked bicep is what is from Chang et al. This is the transfer function that was actually achieved by the most recent bicep paper. Boomerang 03 was pretty contaminated by a flexure in the cryostat, which made us cut large scale, so it's nowhere near as well as you should be able to do from a balloon. So there's a couple scenarios here with the high pass cutoff set to 50 millihertz and 25 millihertz, we expect something in that range for Strider. And the point here is that from the balloon, we can get much better access to the large angular scales. That's why we decided it's important to go from. Okay.
Bart, do you take questions?
From a balloon from Antarctica, we can get about 8% of the sky and see mapped here. Yes.
We have a question from
John. Somebody talk to me?
Yes, so we have a question from John Kovac.
Right now.
Okay. Hey Bart, can you back up to that previous slide?
Okay, what's the question?
Yeah, so on the previous slide, we've had discussions here already, as others have repeated this point about biceps LO37 bin being at 0.3 on the filter function, the transfer function here. So I think all the words that you said are accurate.
Okay, yeah.
But the filter function doesn't reflect the actual information content of the data set. And so it seems a bit misleading to use
right.
this plot to try to say that you can't access the large scales because the filter function is low. The filter function is rolled off the signal and the noise. To the extent that it's rolled them off equally, it's corrected in the analysis and it's irrelevant for the information content. So there's a different plot that can be made that shows how the error bar has actually got larger by the loss of information that was applied in that filtering. And that shows that the loss is between 10 and 30%, depending on whether you're noise dominated or signal dominated. So it's a much less dramatic effect than you're depicting.
I hear you. We've been having this discussion internal to SPIDER as well, on what the right way to handle this is. I'm not really prepared to discuss it much, but your point is will be filed away for some thought.
Okay, thank you.
So like John pointed out, he's not disputing the words you said, but the specific numbers.
The question is what this means in the end. And I think at the end of the day, we're obviously trying both approaches from a balloon and from the ground, and I'm just trying to give you an idea of why we're bothering to go to Antarctica with a balloon. It may not be worth it. It may not. We may get totally scooped by tech, but we might not. So we're going to go for it.
No, I mean, just for the record, I actually don't disagree with the notion that large scales are more easily accessible from balloons. That sounds pretty intuitively obvious. But the plot that's being used and the implications that are being drawn from it is what I'm questioning. So again, it's just this connection between this filter function and the actual information content that I think should be clarified. Thanks.
No, I hear you. I'll give it some more thought.
Is that folding in components separation?
So here's our sky coverage for SPIDER. And so we're getting 8% of the sky, and from this, it's a very good 8% of the sky. So we're pretty happy with this. We obviously can go to less sky if we decide it's worthwhile, but we don't necessarily think it is worthwhile to go with much less. Okay, so how well do we think we're going to do? And that's always a tricky question, right? Because how well could you do if everything works as well as you hope is different than how well you think you're going to do. But you don't want to hear what I think I can do. You want to hear what all of our simulations say we can do. So here we go. The plot here on the top right is if there was a zero R, what would our likelihood function look like? The solid curves assume there are foregrounds, and the dashed curves assume they're not. And the solid curves make a reasonable conservative assumption about the foregrounds. So the orange is our first SPIDER flight, the red is the second compared to Planck in dash blue. And you'd have a hard time deciding if either one is better after the first flight. Planck and SPIDER 1 should be almost identical in how well they can perform. With one slight caveat, Planck splits a signal over the entire sky, and so the Planck curve, the function of how much of the sky you think you can actually use, this is making some sort of reasonable assumption. If you ignore foregrounds, we'll have one sigma around 0.015 or so at all. Foregrounds, of course, will make that a lot worse. How much worse, we'll find out, hopefully, in this flight. The plan is for the first flight to only go with two frequencies in order to verify that we are, in fact, seeing foreground B-modes. And then the second flight will add the 288 to the channel once we've demonstrated that it's necessary, which it almost certainly is. But the first flight will just have the two frequencies. So we'll know what we're seeing for around, we won't be able to remove them, the two frequencies. Let's start talking about the instruments here. Since we're in Texas, I thought maybe we could just actually, where am I? There we go. let me just go give a tour of the high bay here. So where are we? Here is the spider gondola. And let's see if we can find some gondoliers to tell us about it. Ah, there's Jamil.
Hey.
See, can you see Jamil? There he is.
Yeah.
There's Jamil. Jamil's going to tell us about the gondola.
So,
yes.
Yeah, so this, in addition to being the support structure for the prize stack, is also a fully automated pointable platform for the payload. So it's what allows us to scan the telescope in azimuth on the elevation and conduct our science scans. The pointing system is actually my primary area of responsibility, and it's an aspect of the experiment that we can work on. Ground-based telescopes may be less familiar with. We achieve pointing azimuth through two main pointing motors, a reaction wheel and a pivot. So Mark's going to show you the reaction wheel here. This is spokes are about 1 meter in radius, and each one has 7 kilogram brass bricket. And the idea is to maximize the moment of inertia while keeping the thing as lightweight as possible. And then the second pointing motor is up there, where three suspension cables move. And that's the pivot motor. So the basic idea is that the reaction wheel, through conservation of angular momentum, works fairly well to allow us to accelerate the gondola in the absence of external torques. But we need some way of dumping excess angular momentum from external disturbances. And that's done through the pivot motor, which dumps the angular momentum through the flight train up to the balloon in real life. Right now, the pivot is, of course, attached to the hoist hook. So we can point in this way in azimuth fairly accurately to a tenth of a degree or better. And of course, pointing reconstruction is even better than that. And there's another grad student.
So how are we going to actually get 80% of the sky?
Right. So in flight, we scan sinusoidally in azimuth with steps in elevation every second or third turnaround. And we scan such that we have a maximum speed of about 6 degrees per second. But
that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it's pretty fast.
So how fast do these bricks end up going on the reaction wheel?
I think they can go as fast as 60 kilometers per hour. Yeah, when the wheel really spins up.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So about a 40-second period?
47-second scan period, 90 degrees peak.
Yeah. Well, that'll be better for them to see. Okay, so then we might wonder how we know where we're pointed. So here we have Natalie with her pile of pointing sensors. So what have you got here, Natalie?
Spider has a whole slew of pointing sensors that we're going to use during the flight in order to tell which way we're pointed on the sky. This is the most accurate pointing sensor we have, Sharp Camera. So it's just a CCD camera and a lens, and it takes pictures of the sky. This one will be mounted to the prize side itself, and it'll take pictures every time the gondola turns around. And it'll give us pointing reconstruction after the flight to a few arc seconds.
Have we achieved that before?
Yes, so the system's been used on BLAST several times, where the software identifies star patterns on the sky and is able to tell you which stars you're looking at. And since our pixels are around 6 arc seconds big, then we do pretty well reconstructing our model. But in flight, since Spider's beam is so large, we don't need arc second to know where we're pointing to arc second. So we typically use core sensors during flight. And our core sensors include a GPS, a magnetometer, but the best one we have is this, which is a pinhole sun sensor. And it consists of an array of pinholes which shine light onto a position-sensitive diode. And they each have about a field of view of 40 degrees. So we use an array of them to cover more than the amount of azimuth that we want to scan. And these are typically good to about 0.1 degrees. And these also flew on blast pole this past season.
Cool. All right, so there's other parts of this, of course. Let's see, so you might want to hear about our detectors. So for that, I'm going to go to Becky, our resident Caltech agent, who's been spending the last year characterizing detectors.
Okay.
Let's see, I've got a slide here for you, I think. See if I can follow that. Screen share.
There we go.
Right, so our detectors are photolithographically arrayed arrays of slot dipole antennas. Each detector tile contains an 8x8 pattern if it's 150 gigahertz or 6x6 if it's 90 gigahertz. And each pixel contains a slot dipole antenna for both polarizations, which feed via summing tree to two TESs, and then all of which get read out by the MCD time muxing system. There are four tiles per focal plane and six focal planes in the entire spider parasite, which I assume you'll be seeing later. And Caltech has been heavily involved in the process of testing these in our test cryostat. They're made at JPL, so we're a convenient close by test bed for them. And we have five of six telescopes fully fleshed out with detectors.
So inserted right now.
Inserted right now and cold.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And six is on its way.
Six is on its way. Six is actually about to be under test at Caltech.
Cool. So what frequency we've got? 150s and 90s.
150s and 90s. We will have half and half in the final project, 3150s, 390s. We're testing the last 150 at Caltech now. So in the field, there are currently 390s and 2150s.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks, Peggy.
That's great.
All right. So what else we got going on here? I'm sharing our screen.
Bart, there's a question from Seth.
Hey, Bart.
Yes.
Now that you have your detector, are you able to say a word about what your production rate is, or what how many live bolometers do you have out of your goal?
So the question was the detector efficiency.
Not efficiency, but
yield.
Right.
What are the yields like right now?
Total yield, including readout failures, is above 85% on all tiles.
That's great.
And up to 95% on some.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go, Seth. 85 to 95%.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks
for your.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Hold on, Mark. We got one more question.
Here's Bill.
Bart.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Light sensitivity is with the measured
grain. Oh, sorry. We have another question. Are you able to say what the expected in-flight sensitivity and
yes.
Measured
ground. Yes. The expected in-flight sensitivity is in a slide coming up.
Okay.
We can do that now. Let's do that now. Why not? We can be interactive here. So back to desktop sharing. Screen share. Is that working? See the slides now?
Yes.
Whoops.
Where's my slide? There it is.
Okay.
So here's a slide. It talks to us about detectors and sensitivity. So we're predicting here, according to this lovely table, about a 4.8 microkelvin root second sensitivity at 90 gigahertz and 3.6 microkelvin root seconds at 150 for the system sensitivity. So that there it is, and then we're going to have about a 20-day flight. But that, you know, those sort of numbers are the object at the end of the day is to accurately try and convey those into your R limits, which are probably more interesting than sort of detector sensitivities. But anyway, that's what they are. Okay, so let's go back to. There. All right. So, what's up next? That's right. We can go. Come and look at Theo, the current staff. Sasha, tell us all about Theo.
Hey.
I'm a standby Theo. So you're a grad student at Princeton.
Yes. Enter grad
student. Enter your grad student. Yes. Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of enter grad students on Spider. How did this happen? All right. So. There you go. All right, tell us the story.
Theo Dozier Burr. It's a long story about how she got that name, but that's her cryostat. She's a 1,300 liters liquid helium cryostat, and with a 20 liter auxiliary pumped tank. So most of the volume is at 4 Kelvin. And then it holds six independently polarized resistors. These are top. We try to identify whether the ports are currently populated. And each one has a sub Kelvin closed cycle sorption cooler that gets the focal plane down to 300 millikelvin. And we read out each of the telescopes using one of these MTE grids. So time domain multiplexed.
Each one of these reads out how many channels?
The full focal plane.
So what's its status right now?
Right now, it is filled it with helium a couple days ago, and we're waiting for things to settle down.
Okay.
So the main thing we usually wait for is not only just the internal lasers to thermalize, but also the shields around the four Kelvin chain.
So we're hoping for 300 millikelvin in the next day or two.
Yeah, day or two.
That's gonna be cool to know.
Oh, look,
what are these awesome things over the stack of?
Oh yeah, those are some of our baffles. So we want to reduce side load pickup.
So those go on
there. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
The reentrant. Thanks.
Great. Let's see. So what else do we want to talk about here? Oh, more slides. Get more slides. Here, we can talk about the inserts, can't we? Should be sharing screen, here we are. All right, so tell us about the telescopes.
Yeah, so if you're looking at the slides here, so...
Are you guys looking at the slide? Can you guys see the slide?
Yes.
Yep, okay, good.
Cool. So let's start from the bottom and work our way up. So there's a four-kelvin base plate that's sunk into the main tank, and it holds our sorption cooler. And going up from there, there's a focal plane unit that's stood up using carbon fiber truss structure, and it's got a lot of several layers of magnetic shielding and then some optical filtering. And the lens structure above that is all at 4 Kelvin. There's it's a tall central refracting telescope, a pretty simple design based on the BICEP design. And then it's not shown here, but in between the lenses, there's a 2 Kelvin cooled optic sleeve blackened and provides the real stuff for the And then above the lenses, we have a cooled roof plate, and that's sitting at 4 Kelvin as well. Sapphire steps with the sample a couple times a day.
So this design is very similar to what's being used in BICEP 2 and CAT.
Yep.
Each telescope for single frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah, so actually, I don't know if you said this, but currently inside the horizon, we have 390 gigahertz and
250. Yeah, 390s and 250s, and the last one on its way.
Yeah.
That's great. Let's see, what else do we have coming up here to talk about? I wonder if we're more or less done. Well, here you can see there's just the layout we're going to have. And all 390s are in place. This is with the top of the dome off, or the cryostat. The bottom off. This is just a few days ago. And
So the last thing is that the inserts are actually clocked differently because each one is installed independently. You can rotate them to. You can pair up, say, 290 to 250s and get to a new simultaneously.
Great.
Just want to pair telescopes like that.
Okay, you're right. So each one is either Q, each telescope is either Q or U.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And then the wave plate switches between them.
Yeah, and the wave plate, yeah.
Okay. Very good. So here we are. Here's the field team. Just last week, right? You can see the wave plates. The black ones are the 150s, and the white ones are the 90s. And it's all very exciting. It's the day before we close it up. And I think that's about all, except for, of course, the standard slide. So, I don't know, Bill, do you want to add anything to this lovely discussion?
No, you did a great job.
Good. Bill does not want to add anything.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Okay, that was Bill. There's Bill. Bill's doing email. That's what you do in the field. Okay, I think that's everything. Are there any questions before we sign off? Hello?
Any questions?
Any questions for Bart?
I forgot to tell you, this has been recorded. You know that, right? And everybody
no, that's
can.
That's
okay. Okay, all right. Let me know if it's not okay. But
at least Google recorded it, and probably the NSA. So.
Right. So, but if you go to the workshop website, you can see it. You can see all the talks.
Okay. That'll be very exciting.
All
any
right.
Other questions for us?
How long are they integrating? When do they anticipate being done?
Oh, the integration of the instrument?
Yeah. When are they shipping?
When are you shipping?
We're shipping from here in the end of August.
I do have a question.
Dick Bond had a question.
All right.
Shadow of this, or Seth. There were with EVEX, there was 10 days of science quality data, but it was that float for 25 days, and it only went halfway around.
25 days all the way around.
Oh, I see.
So
it comes down to cryogenic cold time. We're projecting
yeah,
about 20 days of cryogenic cold time for Spider. But this is the first run we've had this many telescopes in. So that's a prediction, not a measurement.
Dick.
But we're shooting for 20 days.
The average around circumnavigation is 10 to 12 days, circumnavigation. The 25 days that we had was quite unusual.
Okay.
But what Seth had plotted, he had plotted everything. But it is true that after about 12 days, this was the plan, our helium ran out. This was the plan. We only planned on one circumnavigation.
Okay.
What, the altitude, what altitude are they going to be able to maintain? Their helium's gonna run out, they're gonna drop down a little bit, so, and which decreases the presumed efficiency. What altitude do they need to maintain in order to keep that above their prediction?
Is that a question for me or for Shoal?
For you.
Yeah.
What altitude do you have to maintain?
We're hoping for 120,000 feet.
Throughout 20 days?
Yeah, I figure our minimums will be above 110. But something like that. It should be quite a little bit higher than EVEX because they're a little bit lighter, but pretty similar to EVEX.
So John had a question.
So Bart, you showed really great looking sensitivity projections for Spider 2. I'm wondering if you can say anything more about your plans for that.
Spider 2 gets a bit less than root 2 better than Spider 1 if you ignore foregrounds. But then with foregrounds, you do a lot better because you have a lot better chance of removing them with the 280 gigahertz. So most of the sensitivity improvement with Spider 2 is just flying again. If you didn't have foregrounds, if you do have foregrounds, then you can actually remove them as opposed to not being able to at all. Does that make sense?
Yes. Other questions? Well, let's make Bart Pearson. Thank you. See ya.
See you later.